I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about same-sex marriage. In this upcoming legislative session, the Indiana General Assembly likely again will take up a measure to amend the Indiana Constitution to ban same-sex unions in the state. If the legislature approves the measure, it will go on the ballot in the fall, and Indiana will be ground zero for a national debate about gay marriage. My guests will be Kurt Smith of the Indiana Family Institute, who supports the ban, and Zach Adamson, an Indianapolis Marion County Council member who married his partner in October. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about same-sex marriage. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Kurt Smith of the Indiana Family Institute. Kurt, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Zach Adamson, City County Councilman, who married his partner in October. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
And before we get started, I have to do sort of one of my routine disclosures here, and that is that in a previous career, when I was the executive director of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, now the ACLU of Indiana, we filed suit to challenge the state's ban statute on same-sex unions. For the purposes of this discussion, though, I'm really just going to try to pose the questions and have both of our guests and our callers articulate their positions clearly so that our listeners can make informed decisions themselves. So, Kurt, I'm going to start with you on this one, which is, please tell me why this ban is a good idea.
Well, it's really not a ban. It's an amendment to the state constitution to define marriage. And about a dozen years ago, a court in Massachusetts said marriage is anything we think it should be. And in that case, they said it should be two men, two women, as well as heterosexual unions. So 30 states have passed constitutional amendments, a number of passed statutes. Ours actually predated that case, as you referenced, John. Mm-hmm. And we just want to elevate the definition of marriage into our highest law. We think marriage has a good public benefit. We think it's an appropriate institution for government to afford its highest protection. So this amendment merely defines marriage, but it gives the people the right to decide. And we think we should let the people decide this question because it has become controversial.
Mm-hmm. Zach, why is it a bad idea?
Well, I just believe that in general, the Constitution is no place for this particular amendment. Like Kurt, I do believe that marriage has a place in government. I do believe that the government should be protecting it. But I don't believe that allowing same-sex couples to get married puts anyone else's marriage at risk. I think that the Constitution is a dangerous place for this because, one, we have a law on the books already that does define marriage as between a man and a woman. That law has been upheld by the courts. The Constitution itself, I believe, is not a place to cement a point of view that is, in my opinion, I think a growing sentiment around the country, really, is that it's a dying sentiment into our founding documents for future generations who are wildly opposed to this type of measure. So, for those reasons, I think simply we shouldn't have it in our Constitution.
And that's the other question, Kurt, is since it's already a law, mm-hmm. why do we have to take the additional step of putting it in in the Indiana Constitution?
Two reasons. The first is that it is subject to challenge, and that's happened in Indiana, and yes, two levels of the court upheld it, but there can be other suits.
Yeah, it did not go all the way to the Indiana Supreme Court.
So there's still one level of review possible. But even if a new generation decides to challenge it, you know, it can come back in new and novel ways. So the first reason is to give it the highest protection. That's constitutional law. Trial courts, appellate courts have to kind of align under that. Only the Indiana Supreme Court and then, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court could challenge the But the second and most significant reason is that this is a question for the people to decide. The Constitution belongs to the people. We form our government. We yield our power as citizens to the government to do things. We give it a list of do's and don'ts. And we literally constitute a government with this document. That's why it's called a constitution. And the people should decide this question. It's become that fundamental, that foundational. What kind of a state do we want to be? We think Indiana wants to be pro-marriage, and that's what our polling and other evidence suggests.
We are talking about the issue of same-sex marriage with the upcoming debate, really, about whether Indiana will restrict marriage to heterosexual unions in the Indiana Constitution. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can do what a listener named Jerry has done and send us an email. You can do that by sending us the email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry says, I have been married to the same woman for almost 47 years. I am a father and a grandfather. The institution of marriage is of great importance to me personally, and I think it is important to society as a whole. For this reason, I want to see as many couples as possible happy in happy, stable marriages. It does not matter to me that some couples may be of the same gender, just as it does not matter that they may be of different racial, ethnic, religious, or political backgrounds. I have no more right to choose for other citizens whom they can marry than they have to dictate the personal choices of my wife and myself. What possible infringement of their own rights do the proponents of HJR 6, which is the measure, seek to prevent? Kurt, I think that one's thrown in your direction. Jerry was...
Well, I think Jerry's going to vote no then if the legislature advances the question to the citizens. But the question isn't how does same-sex marriage harm my marriage? It's the question is how does any definition of marriage that isn't one man and one woman where they come together to raise the next generation, how does that impact or dilute or water down the institution of marriage? And let's be honest, marriage is already struggling. We've got high divorce rates. 43% of the kids born in Indiana are born to a single parent. The mom and dad are not married at the time of the birth. Often the father's there and present, but not married. So marriage has already got its issues and challenges. And another effort, this one which would literally redefine the legal definition, we think would do further harm to marriage and make it less likely that kids grow up with their own two parents.
Is that question of children, Kurt, in your mind, essential to the issue? I mean, is that...
Yes.
But then, and I'm going to ask this,
sure,
because it's bound to, uh-huh, to come up. Are couples who do not marry, traditionally married couples who do not have children, less married than those
who
do? No,
they're just as married. And any time a man and a woman come together, there is the possibility of new life. That is the only arrangement where that's possible. Any other coupling does not have that generative, if I can use the biological term, aspect to it. And that's why marriage is unique and distinct. It's special. It's universal. 96% of us will marry at some time. Not all of us will stay married. And it's true in all cultures, even non-Christian cultures, Islam, Eastern. This is the pattern for millennia, one man and one woman to raise the next generation. It's the pattern because it works so well.
Zach, I want to give you a chance to respond here.
Right. I think it's important to also note that, like you said, that 90-some-odd percent of the...
I think it's 96 is what I read, yeah.
96% of people will find themselves married, and I think it's important also to mention that 38% of the U.S. population does live in a state that does recognize marriage equality, and that has been going on for some time now, and somehow, miraculously, the divorce rate in many of those states is actually lower than in states where they have constitutional bans. So the interesting contrast between protecting families and opening marriage equality to same-sex couples, that doesn't seem to hold much water for me. So, and I think that's an important thing. And, you know, again, Judy O'Bannon herself was just recently married to her partner, and she's 78 years old. Her husband is 84 years old, and I don't think they're expecting any children, but their marriage is no less valid and legitimized by the state. And I think that's one of the important things to mention, that LGBT couples are just looking for that kind of recognition and validation from the state.
We are talking about same-sex marriage here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program. John?
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the program. Hello. What's on your mind? John?
I have three questions/points I'd like to make, if I may.
Certainly.
The first thing is that the one man, one woman definition of marriage as passed down through millennia is by and large balderdash. All you have to do is look at the Old Testament. After all, how many wives did Solomon have? How many wives can someone have under the teachings of Islam? How many wives did people in the Indian subcontinent have? So the idea that there's a template for marriage that's one man, one woman is absolutely nonsensical from an historical and even biblical point of view. Second point, if we're talking about the protection, this putting the civil benefits, the non-religious benefits and perquisites of marriage up to a popular vote, I wonder what would have happened if we had done that in the Deep South during the civil rights era, what the good people of Selma, Alabama would have had to say if the issues of civil rights and integration were placed to a popular vote. There are some things that simply should not be placed up to a vote, and this is one of them. Third, there's no threat of any kind to people in heterosexual marriages if same-sex couples were to be granted the legal perquisites of marriage, things like immediate power of attorney, things like that. And I'll take my reply off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call, John. Well, Kurt, I'll give you a chance.
Good. Let me kind of respond to a couple things. Zach has wisely pointed out that marriage rates are dropping, divorce rates. The marriage culture has been damaged by all of this. And all you have to do is look at Massachusetts, where we've had same-sex marriage for the longest time at a state level. And marriage rates are very, very low in Massachusetts. So now to respond to the caller, one man, one woman is balderdash, just not true. I am glad he made the point that one man, one woman is not biblical. We're often accused of trying to pass the Bible. It is not biblical. The New Testament, that 25% of the Bible that comes to talk about Jesus Christ's life and ministry among us, that says church leaders should be the husband of one wife, but nowhere else in the Bible does it say one man, one woman. That's the pattern for most of the marriages that we see, but it's not true for Abraham, the father of our faith. It's not true for others, but it is the template across time. Just read the Code of Hammurabi, which predates all these things you've talked about, and there's teachings in there and what's called a suzerain treaty about marriage and the damages. Civil rights, I agree, we shouldn't vote on civil rights, but marriage is not a civil right. That's not the issue. Segregation was wrong, racism was wrong, and we have many laws and many cultural correctives for that. And I'm pleased that my state and my church and my ancestors were part of reversing that and one of the great movements of people of faith in our country to end slavery begin to tackle racism. But I do think marriage redefinition is a threat to marriage. I think if we say marriage is any two people, marriage becomes about adult desires and romantic relationships. And I not only think that's a harm to marriage and bad public policy, I think everyone who has an adult relationship that they don't want to solemnize in a marriage and accept those rights and responsibilities that implies in the law or that is informed by the law, they're going to rue the day they supported this. I don't think government should be licensing adult relationships. I think marriage is different. I think it's worthy of state solemnization and recognition. I think this is a huge mistake that people in 50 or 75 years will regret. I think it's, as a conservative, recovering libertarian, I think it's a huge mistake.
Zach, we've got just a few seconds. I'm going to give you a chance to respond when we get on the other side and also pick up that whole question of benefits. I mean, there's an economic piece to this puzzle, too, that we should address. We are talking about same-sex marriage here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter. My guests are Kurt Smith and Zach Adamson. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about same-sex marriage today on No Limits. My guests are Kurt Smith of the Indiana Family Institute and Zach Adamson, city county councilman who married his partner in October. Just before we went to break, we got a call from a listener named John who made several points, but one of the ones I don't think we really addressed was the economic impact. What denying partners of the same gender the opportunity to marry or to enter into a union, legally protected union, costs them. Could you talk a little bit about that, Zach?
Sure, and ultimately, that's one of the things I think important to mention that Kurt had said earlier that we don't have a civil right to be married, and I believe that's true. But I do believe that we do have a civil right to equal application of the law, and I wanted to make sure I put that in there. Because that's ultimately what we're talking about, and my ability to secure and validate and have the state recognize and protect my family is equally important to me as it is to Kurt. And I think that's really important. But ultimately, one of the things that my partner and I, my new spouse, really, I'm still getting used to saying it, that we use it as a determiner for whether or not we would make this leap was whether or not there were any financial benefits to doing this. And we called our accountant. We said, hey, look, if we file jointly, since the feds now recognize any legal marriages performed anywhere in the country, would there be a financial benefit? And the accountant came back and said there absolutely would be. So there's a definite financial liability that LGBT couples, whether they're married or not, have to face, and especially in Indiana, where it's not recognized here. So we will be recognized for joint filing by the federal government, but when we do our state taxes, the state is actually now requiring, and this is Governor Daniels just announced this recently, that LGBT couples who are married in another state and filing jointly will have to do a pretend federal return and use that document to do our local and state taxes there. So now when I pay the accountant to do my federal and state taxes, I also have to pay them to do a pretend federal tax document that he can then draw those numbers off of that. And so there's a definite iniquity that we're talking about in financial terms. But there are other protections for married couples that LGBT couples would like as well.
We've got a lot of calls. I'm getting swamped with emails and tweets here. So I'm going to ask also our listeners, when we get to you, make your questions as succinct as possible because we want to give as many people a chance to talk. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask a question before we take another call, though, and that is, does some of the confusion or some of the fact that we call this marriage, I mean, in a civil sense to some degree, it's just a contract. Does that, would calling it a contract and say, make it a little easier, Zach?
Well, I think that the important thing to remember, too, there are two different kinds of marriage that we look at. And one is a religious marriage, which is more of a wedding type situation. And the other is a civil marriage, and that is one that is recognized by the government. If you go to your priest or your rabbi, your minister, and you skip the clerk's office, that marriage is not recognized by the government. So the religious aspect is not the part the government recognizes. If you do go to the clerk's office and have the clerk do your ceremony there, that marriage is considered illegal and valid. And so the definition, I think, is what we're arguing back and forth on. And as I mentioned this to Kurt the last time we came together, I said, you know, the word marriage actually means the coming together of more than one thing to make one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a marriage of ideas when people come together with different ideas and you consolidate those ideas into a single thought. When you're cooking food, foods that have been allowed to set for a while, those flavors have been allowed to marry. That's a common phrase. When I was a waiter in college, I used to wait tables, and at the end of every shift, we used to go around and collect all the half-empty bottles of ketchup. And every night, we would consolidate those into single bottles of ketchup, and that was called marrying the ketchup. And so the definition of marriage is not one that is exclusive to male-female relationships or even just human relationships at all. If it's good enough for ketchup, if it's good enough for an ideal, and it's good enough for chili, it's good enough for me.
We are talking about same-sex marriage here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to make sure was addressed is the two parts of HJR 6. The first, which people are more aware of, which would directly affect future legislatures' ability to allow same-sex marriage, but also the second part, which hasn't been talked about and seems to be conveniently overlooked, which is that it would also make any marriage-like partnerships non-valid. It would make them not allowed the same protections. So whether that be civil unions or domestic partnerships, and those would not just affect same-sex marriages, those would also affect heterosexual marriages. So I think it's really important, you know, as Zach has pointed out and as many people have pointed out, there's no damage to heterosexuals from homosexuals getting married, but by passing HJR 6, we will in fact be damaging some of those relationships between men and women in the state of Indiana. And it's something that it seems like proponents of HJR 6 want us to, you know, leave out so they don't have to address the concerns that that would have in breaking apart even more unions and even more happy families that currently exist in Indiana.
Thanks very much, and thank you. We do need to talk about that second piece. Kurt, thank you.
We have not overlooked it. We intentionally advocated that sentence be included after a long legal review with legal professors. We looked at other states, and the proposed amendment in Indiana was enacted in Kentucky as well as Wisconsin, and we thought our legislators would take some comfort in precedents from near neighbors. Let me just read it. It's 40 words or 39, if I've counted correctly here quickly. Two sentences. First sentence, only a marriage between one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as marriage in Indiana, period. Second sentence, a legal status identical or substantially similar to that of marriage for unmarried individuals shall not be valid or recognized. And I recognize this lady, Mary, may not agree with me, probably won't, but if you understand that we are convinced marriage is a unique and special institution with amazing social benefits, particularly for kids, if you believe in marriage, you don't want marriage substitutes or marriage light. So that was intentionally added in the language to preclude that. Now, it doesn't affect private businesses, doesn't affect IU, doesn't affect Purdue. Those are decisions those institutions make.
And in alluding to those, you know, they obviously feel that there is an impact there because many of them have taken stands opposing HJR 6.
If they're willing to look to their near neighbors, University of Kentucky, University of Wisconsin, they've not. They probably did some administrative things. I don't even know. But, I mean, there's always going to be some movement around these things. But there was no requirement or any rolling back of benefits, and it has affected no private employer in any of those states. Some of our most esteemed invisible employers on this are out advertising on websites in those states that they offer same-sex benefits.
Mm-hmm. Well, Zach, though, if that's the case, why have, it's a laundry list. We've had IU, DePaul, Wabash, at least in my bailiwick, Cummins, MS Communications, a lot of major employers in the state taking a stand against HJR 6, and particularly that second sentence.
Right.
Why have they done that?
Well, I think it's a much broader reasoning than just that second sentence. I think the second sentence is proof positive that this really doesn't have anything to do with marriage and has a lot more to do with marginalizing specific families that are deemed illegitimate by some people. But But I think the reason why this has gained so much traction and opposition from, you know, most of the major universities and many of our larger employers in Indiana is because the amendment itself creates an environment of unwelcomeness. And Indiana needs to create as many opportunities to invite people to move and locate their businesses and invite their employees to come with them to Indiana to stabilize and grow our economy. And that goes for universities as well. I mean, they also have to attract the best and brightest in their staff, and their teachers and their students have to want to move to Indiana, at least for a period of time. And this amendment, I think, creates an environment that is hostile to some people, and whether you're LGBT or not, especially young people, this sends a message to them that this community is backwards and closed-minded, and it isn't a place where they want to grow up or raise a family themselves.
The other question we need to, so that I'm sure a caller or someone sending an email will bring this up, is since the last time I think Kurt was on the show and we talked about this issue, the U.S. Supreme Court has also ruled on the question. How does that change the debate? I think, Kurt, I'll throw it to you. What did the court say in the first place?
The court reviewed two things, the law in California that voters there had approved, and then a federal statute called DOMA, for Defense of Marriage Act. I happened to work on the Hill when it was passed, so I have some familiarity with the law. DOMA has two elements. The first is states, well, for federal purposes, same-sex marriage won't be recognized, so Social Security, other things. The court struck that down, the Supreme Court in June. The second part is states do not have to recognize same-sex marriage if they don't wish from other states, and that basically allowed states to develop their own policy and maintain that in light of what's called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Then they also, for other reasons, said California did it wrong when they passed their marriage amendment. So the court essentially had a states' rights argument. I mean, you could say that. They said it's important for the states to speak to this. The feds will have to follow. Zach detailed some of the complications he'll go through. And I'd love to get your accountant's analysis, because we always hear that it will cost couples because of the marriage penalty. But at any rate, I take your word. I'm sure your accountant got it right, but I'd love to see that analysis. But it just said that the court just said states should decide. So it makes action in Indiana all the more important.
Well, I guess what puzzled me, and I'm asking this question to some degree.
You're puzzled by the Supreme Court's rulings is not a...
Well, and that was it, because I think some of it, it was a divided decision. It was 5-4. And what struck me is in the majority opinion, it said that the federal DOMA law created huge Fifth Amendment problems. Mm-hmm. Couldn't quite understand why it was wrong for the federal government to violate the Fifth Amendment, but somehow it would be okay for a state to do that, if that's the argument. And then Scalia, in his dissent, said this thing is just an invitation for litigation in every state in the country.
Right.
So that it seemed like instead of quelling down the debate, it ratcheted it up to a degree, Zach.
And I believe that when you were mentioning that the 5-4 vote, I believe that fifth vote, Justice Kennedy led on for some very important information in future litigation that very likely will end up at the Supreme Court. This one, if not this one, any one of several from other states, will end up back at the Supreme Court. And I do believe that that they will overturn the state constitutional bans across the country. And that, to me, gives me a lot of concern, especially when we think about the millions upon millions of dollars that will go into fighting this issue on both sides in Indiana.
How much are we looking at having spent? I mean, I've heard numbers that start at $20 million and you know, some of them escalate up as high as more than 100 over the next 12 months.
Freedom Indiana is supporting the ban, and they've said that they're going to raise $15 million.
15?
Yeah. Senator Coates was elected. This is a campaign I'm familiar with, so I know the numbers, with $6 million in 2010.
And keeping that in mind, I think that we have to really look at how much is going to be spent on both sides of this and whether or not we ultimately believe that this is going to end up at the Supreme Court and be overturned. Those dollars are going to go down the toilet when they could have been spent on education, on economic development, job creation, any number of things that actually do help families. And I think that those are the trade-offs that we have to come to terms with. Mm-hmm. I think those are important things to answer.
Well, we think the amendment helps families, so we're comfortable fundraising. We won't raise $15 million. We'll try to be competitive. But if there was such a concern on the other side that this was inevitable or the courts are going to do it or history's on our side, I wouldn't think they would ask all their national donors like George Soros and the Human Rights Campaign and others to put 10 million plus in Indiana.
Well, I think we fight these things very clearly because they're wrong, and that's why we fight them.
Well, and I guess the argument, at least from what I've seen, there's going to be a lot of money coming into Indiana from out of state on both sides of the issue.
I don't know about both sides, but we'll see. I mean,
there was a time when
I'm presuming, Kurt, you won't reject out of state.
We won't, but I can assure you, we've raised less than $100,000 for this effort, and they've hired 100 people and 11 lobbyists, so they're in the seven figures already.
Right. Well, there was a time when Indiana had no trouble raising money from out of state to push this issue forward. Mm-hmm. And that ought to give you some pause and consideration for where this issue is and where
I've been on this issue for years. There's not a lot of money coming in here. I know this pretty well.
Well, I want to get to a caller now.
We rarely disagree, Zach, on those kind of things. I mean, we have a different view of the world. But
Jill, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Oh, I just, as I listen, I become just upset. As a Hoosier, I was born, raised here, married to the man of my dreams, have children. I would just be embarrassed if this passes. I think that it reflects so negatively on who we are as Hoosiers and Christians to see this bill pass. And that's really, and I do, I agree with, from a business point, if you look at the economic impact, I think that it would cripple our ability to bring in startups. I know our direct flights already cripple it, but this would even more. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for the call, Jill.
Thank you.
Well, in terms of where the numbers are here. I know we've had the issue of the dueling polls. I know, mm-hmm. Kurt, your group just released one mm-hmm. not long ago. The numbers do suggest, though, that there's been at least a shift, and I think everyone would agree that the question has tightened a lot more in recent years. Zach, you want to talk a little bit about what the polls have shown you so far, and then, Kurt, what you found? I think yours is the most recent one.
Well, I think what the polls have said, whether or not you believe one poll or another, that, like you said, those numbers have tightened. And again, putting something that is controversial and the public is evolving on currently into our Constitution, I think is what is just tragically misdirected in priorities. I think we should be better focusing on our job creation and economic development than to put something that is currently in flux into our Constitution, our state's founding documents. So whatever those poll numbers are, I think it's indisputable that those numbers have tightened. And I personally believe, just because the number of young people who are coming of age now, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, nonpartisan, independent, you know, whatever, young people by huge margins are against this kind of a discriminatory measure into our founding documents. And Libertarians in general, are coming around to it as well.
Yeah, we've gotten several emails and tweets on that issue and the fact that there seems to be a generational divide on the question. Mm-hmm. Almost every poll seems to indicate older people are much less comfortable with the idea of same-sex marriage, but the younger generation is much more comfortable. Does that concern you, Kurt, at all, into a kind of a generational cul-de-sac?
It wasn't borne out by our polling either. We hired a very good firm, Wilson & Associates. Chris Wilson's done work in Indiana. He's the only Republican pollster who was honored by the Political Consultants Association in 2012 because everyone else got their numbers wrong. So Chris came in and took a deep look at what are called likely voters. You have to think through this, it's kind of counterintuitive, but you got people that could vote, you got people that register, and then you got people that actually show up to vote. So it's a little bit of an art to get at that likely voter. The poll showed a 62-33 support for marriage. Millennials, the young generation, we won them. We had a majority. They moved the most with different arguments, but a majority of young Hoosiers support marriage.
We are talking about same-sex marriage here on No Limits. I am John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about same-sex marriage. My guests are Kurt Smith of the Indiana Family Institute and Zach Adamson, who is a city county councilman who married his partner in October. If you think I'm talking faster, it's because I know we got a lot of people and we want to try to get your questions in if possible. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jason who says, I am a man. My husband and I are legally married in the eyes of the federal government. This year we have been blessed with two daughters that we have legally adopted in Indiana. What would this constitutional amendment mean for my family?
Nothing. It wouldn't change anything. He's married in the eyes of the federal government. That's his view of things. He would not be married in the eyes of the state of Indiana, but it would change nothing.
Zach?
I think what it, again, what the whole point of this amendment does, it does nothing to protect or safeguard marriage or traditional marriage, whatever you want to call it. It quite simply seeks to legitimize and validate some families while bastardizing others. Families today come in wildly diverse structures, single moms, single dads. I'm a product of a single parent family. My brother and I were raised by my single parent mother. We've got grandparents who are raising kids, and these are all the different shapes that families come in now. And I think saying that some families shall be valid and some families will not be valid is very hurtful to families in general. And I think that that's the real damage that's happening here. So I do believe that putting his family, I'm not sure what was his name that you wrote there.
John.
Putting John's family.
Jason's
family, family's validity up to a vote of his neighbors, I think does a lot of damage. So I disagree with Kurt when he says that this wouldn't mean anything for his family. I think it would.
We've also gotten a question, a tweet from a listener named Darren who says, does the state should decide mean that civil rights should be left to a popular vote?
No, I mentioned earlier they should not be. This is not a civil right. Marriage is a unique and distinct institution. It has a special place in our history and our heritage. It has a special place in law today. A majority of our states and the vast majority of our population have affirmed that through referendum in other states. And I think Hoosiers should have the same right. I think we should let the people decide. Jason can vote against it. And he can be, you know, persuasive and talk with people. But I think it's become so controversial and in some ways divisive, although I enjoy sitting down with Zach, and he's a fine man, and I can talk to him, and I respect his role on our city council. But it's become a divisive issue. Let's just let the voters decide.
Mm-hmm. Franklin, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had a question about, I joined the conversation a little bit late, so hopefully I haven't missed it, but about what the evidence was of damage that is posed by the union of same-sex couples. I understand that for some it is offensive and for some it is a belief, maybe religious or otherwise, but as far as evidence that there's damage to the state that would make it appropriate to ban same-sex marriage.
Thanks very much for the call, Franklin, and the question. Kurt, I'll let you take a...
Lots of evidence. Look at the New Family Structure Study, University of Texas at Austin, published in Demography Magazine, I believe. Read the work of Maggie Gallagher, who founded the National Organization for Marriage, but has written extensively. There's also an organization called the Institute for American Values. It's not a right-wing group. The head of it has actually endorsed same-sex marriage, to my surprise, David Blankenhorn. They have a publication that's available online called 31 Findings. The numbers have gone up over the years. I think we're at 31 findings from the social sciences. it all says the same thing. The best thing for kids is mom and dad. We love all kids. We want all kids to be in loving homes. But the best, the ideal, is still the thing that government should hold up. And there's no doubt that the best thing is for a child to be raised by their own two parents, mom and dad. It doesn't mean that every other arrangement is illegitimate or bastardized or other pejoratives like that. It just means that we're going to hold up the ideal and shoot for it. That's one of the things government does.
Zach.
Well, I think it's important to remember too that what we are talking about is singling out certain families for separate treatment under the law here, and so it definitely doesn't have any impact negatively on anybody else's family, and so just going back to that whole premise, I just can't imagine the state's interest in creating this separate subclass citizenship.
Kurt, I'll give you a chance to respond, and then I want to move on.
There's something different about a man and woman coming together. They can have children. And so that's why marriage is different, and that's why we want to hold on to that definition. We think that has meaning in culture and law, and it will help us have the best possible Indiana for gays, for straights, for creative scientists that Lily might want to recruit, or for conservative traditional scientists that one of the other fine medical science companies in our community want to recruit.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Patrick who says, thank you for having the courage to air a program such as this, Mr. Caldwell. I think, frankly, Patrick, a lot of people are going to be talking about this in the coming months. We're not going to be alone on that one. I applaud you and the people. Thank you, though. I wonder if your guest from the Family Institute, Kurt Smith, realizes the arguments that he has wielded against LGBT humans who are asking for nothing more than equal treatment under the law have been trotted out before to rail against interracial marriage. That was eventually ruled illegal 46 years ago under Loving v. Virginia, and yet this same pattern is repeating itself once again.
I don't think that's a fair analogy. Loving was about denying marriage. The power of the state was used inappropriately and wrongly to deny marriage. We're for marriage.
The second part of his question. Let me respond to it in toto, Kurt, is perhaps he could explain to me how this railing against marriage equality for LGBT U.S. citizens is somehow not the same sort of bigotry that was wielded against interracial couples seeking to be married then, and do so in a way that does not completely violate the Lemon Test under the First Amendment. Probably ought to explain to people what the Lemon Test is.
Well, I'm not railing. Mm-hmm. I believe in this passionately, and I think it's worth fighting for, and I have for a decade now. And I think it's a worthy professional pursuit to elevate families, to be pro-marriage. I think if we're successful, as I believe we will be, we'll have more Hoosier kids do well in the next generation. So I'm not railing. And I think Loving, the case in Virginia, is not appropriately compared to this when you really look at the difference. We are saying there is something different about a man and a woman coming together, that there is a state interest in recognizing that they can have kids. Kids do best with their own mom and dad. Let's encourage that. Rights and responsibilities. Other adult relationships, same sex, multiple partners, other adult relationships, we don't think the state has an interest in licensing or regulating. So I see a very different interest.
Well, I guess I'll come back then, Kurt, because I'm going to say I'll break the format of the show here a little bit and just tell you and I have known each other for a long time. Part of the reason I wanted you to be on the show is I know you are sincere, you're a respectful guy and all of that. Is there a way, and I know you are sincere in your belief that this is the best thing for children, is there a way to satisfy your aim of protecting children that also provides Zach and other people who are in his situation who want to have long-term committed relationships with people they love and have those recognized by the state, also have some of the economic. Is there a way to satisfy both of those?
I think it's difficult. I think it's difficult to uphold the principle and then to say, but other things are okay. And once we, quote, violate the principle, unquote, I don't know where we draw the line. So I think Zach deserves all the respect and dignity as a fellow traveler in
Sorry,
life.
Zach, we are where you are in
well,
the room
Well, and he's come forward, and he wants to talk about it, and he's sincere as well, and he's doing his best to guide the community in a conversation that's thoughtful and helpful. And so kind of lost my train of thought there. For Zach to come forward and say, you know, we want this, I just don't see how we reconcile those principles. It's the same as the pro-life debate. Mm-hmm. There's just a principle there that you can't finesse with language or legislate around. You're either pro-life and you believe that life is worth the protection of the Constitution, or you're not.
Well, Zach, and I want to ask you the same question, and that is there a way to satisfy both sets of concerns? And I ask this in spirit, let's face it, in our political culture these days, we've got a lot of people on both sides of the divide who would prefer a fight to a solution. So,
well, but only one of us is on payroll for this issue, and I think that's important to remember. And that's not to just devalue his position on this, but this is my life we're talking about. I don't mm-hmm. do this because at the end of the day I get a
and
check
I hope
to do
I,
this.
I was not speaking disrespect. Did not mean
right.
that.
No, I didn't take any offense to it. I think everything that I've been hearing on this issue from the other side says that, you know, all we want to do is hold marriage as sacred and as a very special thing and protect that definition. And then you add things like the second sentence in that amendment, which just basically illegitimizes anything else that would give us those protections without having that that same name. So I believe that we're hearing talk out of both sides of the mouth on this issue, saying that, you know, what we really want to do is just preserve this one definition and then deny everyone any kind of recognition at all. So
I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't think Zach's illegitimate. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's married mm-hmm. in the eyes of Indiana's law.
We are talking about same-sex marriage here on No Limits. Todd, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I got two quick points. First one, to suggest that this isn't entirely Bible-based or religious, the kindest word I can give to it is phooey. And secondly, the hypocrisy of those supporting this issue to say that this is where the government should step in. Just is unboundful in its hypocrisy. I mean, I am just appalled at what is coming out of his mouth. This is just unbelievable. And I just, you know, to sit there and say that this is not entirely Bible-based, you take that away and you lose 99% of your support for that amendment. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for the call, Todd. Zach, I'm going to let you.
Yeah, just really briefly. I was when Kurt and I had talked a few weeks ago on this issue, I was surprised when he had mentioned that that the arguments supporting this amendment were not religiously oriented. It was a surprise to me because over the last 10 years, as we've been struggling against this issue, I have yet to heard anything but the religious justification for this. So I was pleased to hear that there were at least some other reasons in the background there, but I do believe that saying that they're not religiously motivated is disingenuous. I do believe it is motivated by a bigotry, number one, but justified through religious means.
I'm not a bigot, and you can tell that to Todd too, and Todd can vote no. I read the amendment. There's nothing religious about it. Maybe we could make a distinction between content and intent. Am I motivated by my religious faith? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Are my views of public policy informed by my faith? Absolutely. Did I pull a Bible verse out and try to encourage the legislature to pass that? No.
I think most of them did, though. I think many of
them. I'd be careful. I really think part of the problem in our discourse is that we try to divine people's intent. I mean, that's one of my beefs with the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy is in the middle. Most of our decisions, you got four you can predict on each side. So everybody kind of fashions their laws and their actions for Justice Kennedy, and then he decides. And he said that anyone who supported this kind of legislation had animus in their heart. The courts used it three times, that word. It's a very strong, very harsh word. And I'm offended that a Supreme Court justice would try to divine my motive. I think we should deal like the Indiana courts do with the content, the plain meaning of the language, and jettison what the feds are doing trying to divine people's intent.
We had to talk a little bit before, because we are running up on time here, about why the stakes are so high on this. I mean, why it's coming. We haven't really given people a signal as to why it is important that we deal with this now. I know an email question from a listener named Wes, for example, who's saying, why can't we wait on this question and let time Why is the reason the legislature, Kurt, has to deal with this now?
Our families are in disrepair, and there's a lot of hurt out there. 23% of kids in Indiana live in poverty. The Heritage Foundation did a study of our poverty as they came out here to present at a conference with us, and they said 85% of the poverty among Indiana kids would go away if their mom and dad were married.
Well, let me, but I guess what I'm asking in terms of the procedural stuff here is,
why now?
There is a clock. Yeah, there is a clock that is working.
Well,
on
again,
the
if you
itself.
Believe this strengthens families, you'd want to do it yesterday. Yeah. And I wish we'd done it last, you know, I wish we'd done it in 2006, but there was a change in the legislature, so the process was halted.
Yeah, and the legislature has to deal with it in this session, right, Zach?
Or, no, they don't have to deal with it.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, if they don't deal with it procedurally, yeah. The clock restarts and the
yes,
whole process.
Right, yes,
and
right.
Indiana's constitutional.
Yes. And I think that there's some merit to allowing that to happen. I mean, clearly, as people and society and our fellow Hoosiers are evolving on this issue, I think we're even seeing legislators coming out, if you will, very slowly, but they're coming out against this amendment. Some that have voted for this in the past have stated that they're not going to make that mistake twice. And these are Republicans, Democrats on both sides of the aisle. This is losing steam with the electorate. I think that's the first indicator that we ought to put the brakes on this.
There's no evidence it's losing steam with the electorate. The Ball State poll, none of that is given.
And in the Ball State poll, it did show that there was a majority opposed to the amendment. But, and this is a crucial distinction, even in that poll, it suggested if it actually made it onto the ballot, the margin was razor thin.
Right.
We were talking about a point well within the margin of error.
And they did a sample and then they weighted it. That's not
but
a
at
good
the same
poll.
Time, that
that's
is
not a good poll, John.
Those are not the same numbers that we would have seen when this move to amend the Constitution started how many years ago?
Oh, I think maybe 2004, maybe 5.
Yeah, these are not the same numbers we're talking about. So, again, I think that the legislature owes future generations of Hoosiers the deliberate dialogue and due process of making sure that they're putting into our founding documents something that will not only last for generations but also be the will.
But under that theory, we would never address a public question because it could change in the future.
Well,
and 100 years from now, people might feel or think differently. They could just reverse the Constitution. We've done it before.
Well, reversing the Constitution, getting the Constitution amended, as we've seen in this particular instance, is a very difficult process, and thank God for that.
Yeah.
Will this? I'm going to step in because we're very close. Will this thing make it out of the legislature, Kurt?
Yes, I believe so.
Zach?
I believe it's very possible, but every day I am I'm becoming more optimistic that the legislature will do the right thing.
And okay, you don't have to take my word. They're spending $15 million and they're hiring lobbyists and field staff.
I think that probably will have to be not the last word, because I have a sneaking suspicion we are going to be talking about this question. I want to thank you both, Kurt Smith, Zach Adamson, not just for an informative discussion here, but also the fact that it was a civil one. I think we strive on this program to provide more light than heat, and I think we did that here thanks to you. I also would like to thank all of our listeners, including those who tried to call in or sent us emails or tweets. We will be talking about this again, and I hope you will join us. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.